1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
I mean, the overarching reality about on the hygiene issue is just that it's very clear people are not taking this seriously enough in terms of officials at the prison. I was hearing from someone yesterday who was saying they were wearing underwear as a face mask. I mean, this sort of ad hoc, once again, sort of ad hoc way of addressing a virus like this and trying to stay safe is deeply, deeply distressing when you imagine being trapped in a place where you're trying to stay healthy and, you know, you're resorting to putting your underwear on your face.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Yet another week here in the quarantine closet on Why Is This Happening? With the recording equipment from the great Kate Shaw, who is both anchor producer, A2, love of my life, and host of Strict Scrutiny Podcast, which you should check out, which is recorded also on this this fine audio equipment. Since the beginning of the COVID epidemic, I've been hearing from people. I have a lot of friends. I would say Kate and I have a lot of friends, associates, people we know in the world of criminal defense, particularly public defenders, criminal justice advocates, people that work at legal clinics that represent people that are in prison. I have a lot of sources as a journalist with immigration lawyers who deal with people who are in detention, doctors on Rikers. There's the whole sort of world of folks that from the first moment the pandemic started to hit, I started hearing from, this is going to be a disaster in jails, this is going to be a disaster in prisons, this is going to be a disaster in ICE detention facilities. And that proved prescient. The New York Times the other day published a list of sort of the top 10 hotspots per capita. And basically, like the first 30, I think, were all either nursing home facilities, meatpacking plants, or jails, prisons. Like those three kinds of facilities made up basically the entirety of the top 30 list. When you look at like where outbreaks are most intense, there have been a bunch of different outbreaks. It's sort of hard to kind of get your head around it. So I wanted to kind of take a macro view of all this. And I've been wanting to have our next guest on the podcast for a while. I've been reading her forever. I listened to her own podcast, which is called Justice in America. She's the president of The Appeal, which is a great publication you should check out that does criminal justice reporting. Her name is Josie Duffy Rice. She's a journalist and lawyer, and she joins me now. Great to have you, Josie.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So The Appeal has been doing a lot on this topic throughout the pandemic. How would you, I guess, let's sort of start at the broadest level. Like, what is the status of where we are in terms of America's incarcerated populations in this epidemic?
Well, what we know is that it's really bad. That sounds simple and a little trite, but that's probably the best way to put it, right? I mean, you said earlier that when we talk about clusters of this virus, I think last I looked, it was 8 out of 10 of them were prisons. And like you said, the other one, there were some nursing homes and some meatpacking plants, basically places where people are isolated and can't have no option of leaving functionally. And we know it's really bad. We know that there are people dying. We know that there are tons of people getting sick. We know that the rates in prisons and jails tend to be 10, 20, 30, even 70 times as high as they are in the surrounding community. But on the other hand, we don't totally know how bad it is because we are not getting a ton of testing in these facilities, just like we're not getting a ton of testing anywhere. Right. You know, prisons are function the way they do because they're so opaque and because we can't see inside. And this is an example of the inability to really be able to see the whole picture of what's happening inside of these facilities. We don't actually know, you know, you're taking correction, Department of Corrections word for it on how many people have died, how many people are sick, et cetera. But we know that those numbers aren't comprehensive. And so we know it's much worse than what we know.
Yeah, that's been a difficult part of even just assembling the data. My understanding is, I think there's some law students, I think out of University of California, perhaps, or and you guys at The Appeal have both been essentially kind of as catch as catch can, like going through to pull together an aggregate data on this. Is that right? Like there's not like some single actual official source on this.
No, you know, it's state. I mean, this is like, anytime you're trying to get any data about the criminal justice system, it's like so unbelievably dispersed. There's no central kind of repository that you can rely on for up to the date data about pretty much anything in prison. And this is just like a nightmare in that way, because you can't even just go to every state. You basically have to go to every facility. You have to make sure that they're reporting. You have to know that they're testing. You know, it's really, like you said, just sort of an ad hoc process.
And I also sort of feel like when the data that there is suggests a case fatality rate that's like 1/5 as high as it is in the general population.
Right.
And I just don't think that's probably accurate. Although if it is accurate, it makes me wonder, like, is that just a demographic thing, which is that, like, if you took nursing homes out of, you know what I mean? Like, nursing homes are a very specific kind of risk. They're accounting for a massively disproportionate amount of fatalities. And the median age in prison is, you know, in some cases can be higher than you'd think, but is generally not that high compared to like nursing homes. So
that
could be part of it. But part of it just makes me think that like the data it's garbage in, garbage out. Like, we're just not getting the full truth.
Yeah. Like, if I were betting the farm on it, right, I'd bet the data's bad. I can't think of a worse place. I mean, other than maybe a nursing home. And again, I think that's a function of age, like you said, for something this contagious and unpredictable to spread than a prison. It just, there's nothing in a prison that is set up to protect not only the people serving time, but the people working there from getting sick. And it would just be very surprising to me if we found out that actually prisons were the healthy place to be during their coronavirus pandemic, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about what healthcare systems are like generally in facilities like this? In normal times, like both, I know that I talked to a bunch of people about like just like how hard it was to get soap, sufficient soap. Just getting soap was like a problem.
Right.
That was like seen as like a benefit, a perk for prisoners. Like what the general level of sort of hygiene as provided by the you know, warden and facilities themselves, and what healthcare is like in prison.
Yeah, so you're highlighting two different, but I think obviously very related and very important things. So starting with the hygiene issue, what we're hearing mostly is people just not having access to any sort of PPE. And I mean, I'm including everything in that, right? Soap, hand sanitizer, gloves, masks, anything that would prevent even a slight germ spread. And so it's, on one hand, people not having access to it at all. Like, they just can't get it, you know, no matter how much money they have in their commissary account. And on the other hand, it's people paying, you know, upwards of $10 for a bar of soap or something ridiculous, which also just highlights how prisons are, like everything else, sort of a have and have not situation in American society, right? You know, even in prisons, there are people who have the privilege of having family and friends who will give them money to put in their commissary account so they get soap. And then there are people who don't have that. The overarching reality about on the hygiene issue is just that it's very clear people are not taking this seriously enough in terms of officials at the prison. I was hearing from someone yesterday who was saying they were wearing underwear as a face mask. I mean, this sort of ad hoc, once again, sort of ad hoc way of addressing a virus like this and trying to stay safe is deeply, deeply distressing when you imagine being trapped in a place where you're trying to stay healthy and, you know, you're resorting to putting your underwear on your face, right?
It's also like, you know, this has been the case in every institution, in every facility in American society, which is like, you don't necessarily have a bunch of public health experts at your disposal. So everyone's sort of figuring it out. But like, you, if you're like, let's say you're an employer, at like a fancy law firm, your worry about your employees getting sick and how they might react if you got them sick is going to factor in like how seriously you take it and what level of risk you deal with.
Exactly.
If you're like the warden of a prison, right? Like, it just seems like there's also a recipe there for just not frankly fully valuing or even having official mechanisms of accountability exist
Exactly.
When the people that are being quote unquote cared for are prisoners.
Exactly. And that really goes to your second point about healthcare, right? So, and it's actually interesting because prisons are one of the few places that the law says require healthcare. So in theory, you would think, I don't know, I mean, maybe you wouldn't think, but you could imagine that that would mean that there would be some sort of standard of healthcare in these facilities. That's absolutely not the truth, right? So if you are serving time in a prison and you go and you say, I think I have COVID-19 symptoms, and they say you have allergies, right? You can't go to a second doctor. You can't report that first doctor for, you know, clearly not seeing the signs. There's no sort of malpractice suit you could file, or there's no reputational, you know, really reputational harm for the people, the healthcare officials. Now, that's not to say that all or even most of the people providing healthcare and facilities are incompetent, because that's certainly not the case. We see incredible doctors in many of these facilities, but you also see them not have the access they need for the resources they need, right? And you see them get sick. And then you have this other problem, which is like, there just aren't enough doctors in a prison, right? You're talking about places with hundreds of people who are malnourished much of the time, who don't have access, again, to any sort of ability to social distance or wear a mask or do any of the preventative measures. And then you have one doctor for hundreds and hundreds of people. It is everywhere you turn, there is sort of an insurmountable obstacle when you're trying to address something this severe and this quick, fast moving in one of these facilities.
Well, and also you just mentioned like the ability to social distance or physically distance. Like I'd heard, you know, Rikers is an interesting situation. Rikers, which is the jail here in New York City, which is notorious. Mm-hmm. If anyone outside New York, you probably have heard about it in some way, shape or form. It's going to be closed down. And there's a very controversial battle about what replaces it, essentially,
right?
Like a bunch of mini Rikers spread around the city or not.
But
its population has declined significantly, sort of for a variety of reasons having to do with the criminal trends of crime in New York, and also in preparation for shutting down. And so I've heard in Rikers, they have taken some steps to physically distance people, partly because they have the space there. But my sense is that, you know, and I've looked at some of the data here, like a lot of these facilities are already overcrowded. There is literally no place. You cannot say, oh, every other cell block, we're going to put, you know, we're going to go from everyone next to each other. And now we're going to no longer have roommates because they can't do it.
Right. And you know what's interesting about that? I think that most people, when they imagine a prison or a jail, they think about a cell, two people next to a cell, two people. You know, you picture the scenes in the movies where you're walking down. I mean, that is many facilities. And then in some facilities, it's like dorm style. You're packed in a room with, you know, 40, 50 other men in bunk beds that are next to each other. You know, there's literally no, I mean, it's the summer camp from hell, functionally. You know, you can't, there's no way to kind of get away from people, and it's just not built for it. There's never been a real consideration of something like this happening in really in America ever, right? Like, we're clearly not prepared for a pandemic. We're certainly not prepared for it in our criminal justice system. And on the, you know, what the other thing we're seeing is that in some places, the way that they're addressing this harm is, okay, someone is sick, we're going to put them in segregation, right? We're going to put them in what is functionally solitary confinement, which is...
Congratulations, you have COVID, you're now going into solitary.
Right. And not solitary, you know, I mean, in some ways, what's happening to everybody is they're kind of going into solitary. You can't see your friends, you can't see your family when you're very sick.
Which, but again, like, it's kind of a worst, there's not a lot of great options here, right? Like, it's not like I think that impulse is crazy. Like, I understand the impulse.
Right.
The idea that you have it in your facility, the facility is overcrowded, it's not a place designed for physical distancing. It's like, then what do you do? That sort of like arising in the minds of officials as a means, but like it's deeply perverse to take this thing that is traumatic and also seen as punishment and use it as a sick bay.
Exactly. And, you know, the answer of what do you do ultimately is decarcerate. I mean,
right.
I'm certainly coming from this from a perspective of already believing in decarceration. So, you know, this isn't something I just started thinking about a few weeks ago, but there is really no way to address this, right? And to mitigate the harm. I think one of the things that people don't think about is so many people get out of prison and jail every day, right? Like prisons and especially jails, like they are
jails particularly.
Yeah. It's fully a revolving door, but even in prisons, I mean, like, you know, thousands of people are getting out of prison every day. We talk all the time about 95% of people will come home at some point. And the question is, you know, so there's this one part, which is we're getting people sick and then theoretically we're releasing them into the general population, right? And then the other part is people work at prisons, right? They work at jails. And so many of these places are in rural areas where the local economy is built on the, you know, the local prison. And people are going into work, essential workers, getting sick, going back to their families, going back to their kids, going back to their elderly parents that live with them, going, you know, prison health is public health functionally. And what we are seeing is a refusal to acknowledge that even if we were okay with everybody in prison being sick, which some people are completely fine with that. Even if you're okay with that, it doesn't stay there. This is a porous system. It really is. And the idea that it's really that just because people are isolated, the system is isolated is really a strong misconception. That's going to get a lot more people sick.
You said before that the solution here is to decarcerate. And I want to talk about that for a bit because, I mean, I think that's also true, but mm-hmm. I also believe in decarceration as a project. And there's right. a little bit of the like now more than ever problem here, right? Which is like, you know, like you get these emails from brands being like now more than ever, it's time to like buy our shirts. It's like, right. well, I don't think the code, like, it's like, right. and there's a, right. there always had a little bit of the smack, like all the emails I was getting from criminal justice reformers always had a little bit of that. Cause like, well, you know, you wanted to decarcerate in December, you want to decarcerate right. now, and this right. is a reason to do it. So I guess, you know, why specifically this, there is a real relationship between the two? Because I think there is, but like for people yeah. that say, well, this is your ideological project anyway, like why is it responsive to the public health concern?
I have to say, I was talking to my mom about this and I was saying, well, it's just time to let people out of prison. And she's like, you always say that.
You exactly. know,
she made it pretty clear that I've been beating this drum for a long time. Look, like to me, the more I do this work, the more I keep coming back to the same kind of fundamental questions, right? And one of them is about public safety. Like if this entire structure is set up for public safety, right? Let's take that at face value. Like, let's say that this structure is set up on, you know, for completely benevolent reasons to keep the rest of us safe. Is this public safety? Is it public safety when, the crisis that faces us is a virus that all of us are at risk of being severely harmed by. I mean, many of us would not be severely harmed by it, but all of us have the potential to be severely harmed by it. Is it safe to keep people in prison as in the interest of public safety? Like, are we actually, doing the opposite of what the system is set up to do? Right. You know, what is the cost of our addiction to punishment? Because a lot of this is just punishment. You know, in Delaware a couple of weeks ago, there's this, the Department of Corrections, someone at the Department of Corrections said, you know, they weren't even considering letting people out and that COVID-19 was being used as an excuse to try to get people out. And the next week, two men over 65, one was 73, I think, and one was 79. So over 70 died of COVID-19. Like, were those men a public health risk? He's 79 years old. Like, what is in that moment? Is it more important to punish this man for any harms he's done, which may have been very severe harms? I'm not trying to downplay the severity of some of the crimes that people are accused of or convicted of, but is punishing him worth right. his life and the lives of those around him.
And then this gets back to sort of the place I started, which is that when you start to think about it like that, and I think that's a really reasonable way to think, like, okay, let's just say everyone over 75 in the prison system in America, like, that's a Venn diagram where their risk is super high to their health. We know that the data we have. And from the other data we have, they're a very low risk to public safety. Like, there's two sets of data. Like, do people commit a lot of violent offenses at the age of 75 plus? No, they do not.
Right.
Do people have disproportionate mortality from COVID-19 at 75 plus? Yes, they do. Okay.
Right.
So Venn diagram. Like, that seems to me like, let's let those people out. But then it also makes you think of the sort of idea before the disease, which is like, why do we have 75-year-old people in prison?
Exactly.
And the answer is because we punish them with years of their life, and if they did something that we deem worthy of a long punishment, and like you said, some of them have done truly terrible things, then they stay in there. But the public safety rationale, like, you know, are you and your family going to be safe? It is immaterial whether X number of 75-year-olds are or are not behind bars for your public safety.
You know, I think this highlights something that you see kind of in every aspect of political decision making. And this may be kind of particularly American. It's a failure to play the long game in a very, very serious and like stark way. And by that, I mean, you know, for years, public health experts have been warning that a pandemic like this is possible, right? And that we're overdue for it. So that's one part of it. You know, you think about the 90s and the 2000s in particular, even though we haven't stopped doing this entirely, we've certainly slowed down, where we were sentencing 20 and 30-year-olds to 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 life in prison. And even let's add in the 80s and that, right? So you could have seen this coming. Maybe you couldn't have seen exactly what's happening at this moment. You couldn't have read the future this specifically. But we knew that we were going to have prisons full of elderly people. We've known for decades what happens to people after the age of 25. The risk of them committing serious crimes is reduced significantly. And then after 40, it's reduced even more, right? So we actually know that people change, evolve, become less likely to do things that would land them in prison. And yet here we are in this situation. But I think the other point that your Venn diagram makes is that there are people in there who are not 75. You know, it's easier for people to say, well, if you let out this 50-year-old, they could go do something horrible again. But we also know that even the risk of that is really, really low. And I guess the question here is also about risk. What are we, is that our main concern, or is our main concern keeping people safe in this moment from this pandemic?
That's the sort of amazing thing about the risk conversation, which is like, when you think about the way that risk gets talked about, particularly among a certain small but very voluble part of the right now, which is kind of like, hey, basically life happens and, you know, get out there, you're warriors, and like a few hundred thousand dead Americans, like, you know, well, people die from swimming pools. And it's like, try using that logic about crime.
Exactly.
Like, about murder victims. I mean,
exactly.
You know, first of all, it would be like gross and sociopathic and unempathetic to say that to someone who's like the survivor family member of someone who's been murdered. Like, you wouldn't say to them, like, a lot of people die from the flu, because you would sound like a sociopath. Like, you would be like, I am so horribly sorry for what happened to you. Like, what? Like,
right.
So like, more people have died in New York City from this one pandemic than in the last like 20 years of homicide, I think, is the stat. It's something like that.
I think it's almost twice as many. I mean, I think
twice as many. And so it's like the stat of like, what is the risk? It's like, at one level, conservatives are like, we need to build this enormous police state to to keep you safe, mm-hmm. to protect you and your family. You have to buy guns for you and your family. We also have to build this enormous war on terror that costs trillions of dollars and has cost thousands of lives and extends over two decades. Like, all of that built out of the aftermath of 3,000 Americans murdered.
Right.
And then we have to build like all these things are enormously powerful and expensive and whatever. And then it's like a pandemic comes in, it's going to kill over 100,000 people. And it's like, hey, you know,
that's
stuff happens.
The risk. Right. Exactly.
And it's like,
that's the risk.
It's just
take.
Like they're not the right. same risk conversation, which makes you realize it's not really about risk, right? It's about
exactly.
something else.
Exactly. And that, I mean, it's been really interesting to watch this risk conversation play out, because for so long, so much of the conversation in criminal justice has been about risk. You know, you hear it all the time with getting rid of bail, for example. Okay, we'll put risk assessments in, which are supposed to be able to tell you what's going to happen, what someone's going to do tomorrow or the next year, and whether or not we should be keeping them locked up. When the reality is, like, you really can't eliminate risk. And we've given people this false sense that the more people you lock up, all you're doing is reducing the risk to you. We know that in reality, that's not how it plays out, other than the fact that obviously if you lock everybody up, there's nobody left to murder.
Yes.
So, I mean, in
yes.
theory, like, you could right. go all the
at
way.
At the extremes. No, at the extremes. I made this point in my last book, which is that, like, clearly at the extremes, the argument
right.
holds. Like,
right.
a society that decided to literally put every male 16 to 29 behind bars for the duration of that time would see less crime. Like, that
totally.
That is true.
Totally.
But also, that would not be a tenable society.
Right. I mean, I ask people all the time about when they talk about, well, how do you suggest we control crime? And, you can live in a society without crime. I mean, it's possible. There's very little civilian on civilian crime in North Korea, for example, because, right. you know, from what we know, because the punishments are so severe that who's going to commit a crime. But do you want to live in North Korea? I mean, I'd rather right. live here and have the one in literally a million chance that someone breaks into my house. Right. I mean, the other thing is that the risk conversation is always centered around communities where there basically is no risk, right? Like, there, you can, in the suburbs in America today, crime rates have lowered significantly, but they've also gotten so much more geographically concentrated that you can I could put my 2-year-old outside with a sign that said, take me, and nobody's kidnapping my 2-year-old. It's just not happening. I don't even right. live in the suburbs, but right. we don't, you know, the idea that, like, at every minute you're at risk of something horrible happening to you at the hands of someone else is just actually not accurate.
It's funny that geographic concentration was always really clear to me when I lived in Chicago, where, like, it was so intensely geographically concentrated, and it was so bound up with sort of gang affiliation generally, mm-hmm. or sort of chains of reprisals, essentially, particularly on the
right.
homicide part of it.
Right.
It always, even though, like, I lived in a neighborhood like that, even the neighborhood actually had, like, a fairly high homicide rate.
Totally.
I did not feel
no
unsafe or threatened, because it was like I was not part of the chain of reprisals that
right.
that constituted what had, you know, these sort of very violent vendettas that have been unfolding. And so, like,
right.
or even like block by block, like, the concentration of the risk is so intense. And yet, and again, like, see, this is where, like, this fascinating through the looking glass moment with the pandemic and risk is that, like, conservatives making these arguments that are sort of, like, vaguely familiar to me of, like, lefty arguments about terrorism and crime,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is like, okay, freedom implies some amount of risk. A, B, the media is scaring you about a thing that's actually not that common, like,
right.
they're like, and so, like, they're making these inversions, except the math, I think, is, like, on the math is on the side of the pandemic being a genuine threat and not on the side of, like,
right
a random stranger crime being
right.
a real threat, like, just in terms of the actual math of it. And yet they're, like, these sort of versions of each other's argument.
Yeah. And I think the other part of that, right, is that, well, two things. One is that we have 30 years of pretty strong data that can tell us who is at risk of committing severe crimes and who's at risk of being a victim, you know, being harmed by those crimes. Like you said, most crimes, especially most, like, murders, for example, are interpersonal. They're murders between two people who know each other. we see a lot of obviously domestic violence and stuff like that. But the idea of you walking down your street and getting shot is rare. Even when you're in a city, you know, you always hear conservatives talk about Chicago. As you said, even in Chicago, you know, all the places you're in, that's never a risk. And most of the places you're in, even interpersonal violence isn't any more risky than it is anywhere else. And then the one thing is, we know actually on the criminal justice end what we're working with to some extent, where we don't know what we're working with this virus, right?
Like we actually have like more developed, we have a longer record and we have more data that has happened over a longer period of time with more study than we have on the virus.
Totally. I mean, like this virus showed up 20 minutes ago. I mean, functionally, right? I mean, it's where everybody, the experts too, are trying to figure this out. And then I think there's this other thing, which is I think criminal justice advocates are in part saying, think about the costs of this, right? The cost is people, the cost is families, the cost is, you know, entire neighborhoods. When I worked at Bronx Defenders, I will never forget that I taught an after school program at a local elementary school, and all of the kids there, their parents were clients at Bronx Defenders, right? Like what the criminal justice system had ravaged in neighborhoods. And so that's one cost of the criminal justice. You know, the horrors of the criminal justice system, the cost of the pandemic is the economy, which is not a small thing, but.
Right. And in fact, when you say the cost of it, right, like, again, that's again, to come back to like the analog, right. That is right. the Trump et al. Argument. Right. We can't let the cure be worse than the problem. We can't let the cure be worse than the disease. Like that there are, but again, and I don't think, I think, you know, my feeling about this is like, yes, you should apply these sorts of ways of thinking of weighing different costs and benefits and risks to all these different things, right? I mean, like, we should weigh that on terrorism policy. We should weigh it on criminal justice.
Exactly.
Like, what exactly are we, what are our goals and principles as a society? What are the actual risks that we're concerned about? And what are the costs of the solution we come up with? And, you know, locking up every 16 or 17 year old black teenager in a given neighborhood or giving them all arrest records, like that's a really high cost with, that doesn't produce the risk diminution that you would want.
Right. And I think, I mean, to your point, it's also just a false choice, right? Like we actually know that you can, again, stop all street crime by taking off every single person on the street. Right. Sure. But we also know that you can really reduce crime by giving people quality educations, providing good after school programs, making sure that people have, you know, enough money to feed their family, making sure that parks have street lights. Like there are all of these ways that we can address crime and we choose not to do them in the same way of the pandemic, right? The government doesn't have to let the economy fall apart.
Right.
But if they're saying it's economy versus people, when there's this third choice, which is, why don't you guys get it together and actually
solve the problem in a way that doesn't hurt people?
Exactly. You could be, you know, the unemployment rate doesn't actually have to be 14.4% or whatever it is today. You know, it we don't have to be here. And the idea that like it's either our health or our wallets is just, you know, made up.
Yeah, that's true. Those the sort of ways that the trade-offs get kind of couched to people that sort of pushes them into accepting things that wouldn't otherwise be acceptable. I mean, and this is true of, you know, I think it's true of the way that the kind of drug war and war on crime was sold, even in, you know, neighborhoods in New York that are predominantly African American that I know and did reporting on, like, where there were significant constituencies who sort of had been sort of effectively boxed into thinking they had a binary choice.
Right.
Between like, I don't want the dealers on my corner. I don't want to feel bad, like unsafe when I walk into my house. And so then it's like that, or they're going to start sweeping up all the teenagers in my neighborhood and like, well, which do you want? And that becomes the choice that is presented to people.
Right.
And again, that's exactly like these sort of sense that like, the role of the state is to actually come up with like creative and non-zero sum problem solving that can, I mean, trade-offs are unavoidable in all areas of life. So like, you can't get rid of them, but like to come up with creative problem solving that minimizes the trade-offs is kind of the job we want the state to do.
Exactly. And this idea that, I mean, you hear the Trump administration kind of say, well, which one do you want? And it's
Yeah, that's
your entire job is harm mitigation, right? That's the entire point of government. It's very bizarre to, I mean, it just signals to me so strongly of how we've effectively lost that as like a quality of government that we are willing to rely on or even expect.
So Josie, you live in Atlanta, is that right?
I do.
You live in Atlanta, Georgia.
I do.
I want to talk about some of the stuff happening in Georgia, particularly the story of Ahmaud Arbery and what's going on with his case, his young man who was shot and killed in Georgia in February. We're going to talk about that right after we take this quick break.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So, Josie, the case of Ahmaud Arbery has sort of built over time, and I think in a non-pandemic world would have probably exploded as a much bigger case. Mm-hmm. I think the pandemic being what it is just like covered everything. But there's been video revealed. There were two white men, a guy and his son, who essentially chased this 25-year-old black man who was out for a jog. They say because they thought he looked like some suspect of robberies. They get out of the car. They challenge him. They end up shooting and killing him. And tell me a little bit about I'm very curious what the kind of local coverage, local reception of that story has been, because I've really only experienced it as a kind of national story.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, because I was just looking, I think a couple of things. One is that obviously local media is so decimated that I'm not sure most of what I'm hearing about this has been national, right?
Oh, wow,
the AJC, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, has covered it, but I don't think has covered it much more closely or was covering it much more before it became a national story. But relatedly, the Waycross Recorder, I think, was the local paper down there that recently closed about 6 months ago. It shut down. It didn't have any more resources. And so, you know, that entire county doesn't have the paper it had for decades.
Wow.
As of recently. And I think that's not unrelated to the fact that, you know, this story is 2 months old and only now really getting picked up. But Atlanta is quite different from the rest of Georgia, obviously, but we've spent some time down there. My brother actually lives just outside of Ware County and jogs and is black. And it is a place where accountability for local officials and particularly the criminal justice system is non-existent. There have been so many cases down there of, of innocence cases, people wrongfully convicted, or bad forensic science used to convict people. I wrote this story for the New York Times a few years ago. This woman, black woman, was working at the polls. Someone asked her how the polling machine worked. She said, "You just put your card in, you vote." Woman left, and this woman was charged with felony voter fraud, almost sentenced to 15 years in jail, went to trial twice, was finally acquitted.
Wait, I want to just be clear. This is a woman just answering a question she thought helpfully to explain to a person she thought was a potential voter how to use the machine.
Never told her who she should vote for, never even went to her machine, never touched, you know, like just the way that you would answer the question if someone said, "How do I use the voter machine?" And what the DA down there is oversees multiple counties. He is a strong Republican. He got reelected a couple of years ago without any challengers. And when you don't have local media, when you have a system that is historically been extremely racist, and there's really no oversight, this is just inevitable. I mean, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying, and nothing about it is surprising.
That prosecutor, that woman, they tried her twice. She was acquitted, right? She's Was that near where this incident happened?
So what we have in Georgia is that outside of Atlanta, counties will all be in the same judicial circuit. There will be one DA for the judicial circuit. She was in Coffee County. This happened in Ware County, same judicial circuit. So same DA.
And so the same DA that the same DA's office that declined. Well, I guess they recused because one of the assailants in this case used to be a DA investigator, right? Worked in the DA's office.
Well, he eventually recused. But at first, he just wrote a letter saying this. I mean, it literally says in the letter, this is perfectly legal.
Literally. That's the phrase.
Yeah, perfectly legal. I mean, this is a citizen's arrest. I mean, anybody, the law can be, again, very opaque and like unnecessarily confusing. You can read the citizen's arrest law in Georgia and anybody who can read knows that this is not a citizen's arrest, right? But when I've been kind of trying to thinking through this point in the past couple of days, because it just to me proves that the law is not static. And we actually know that it depends on where you are and who you're talking to and who's in the DA's office and what you look like and what the police officer looks like and who the defendant is, depending on what the law says. Because functionally, without this video coming out, his belief that that was voter fraud, cost this woman years of her life. And his belief that this was a citizen's arrest would have sent those two men home without a second thought for the rest of their lives. It just totally depends on who's the person in charge of making these decisions.
I mean, you want to think it's something more than that, right? Like,
yeah.
I tend to think that my wife, who's been a free guest on the podcast and is well known to listeners
and a badass lawyer.
And a badass lawyer, a phenomenal lawyer, and also like both an extremely critical lawyer, but also someone with genuine, and I find like inspiring faith in the rule of law as like a concept, not as like a reality in America, but as a kind of thing to aspire to, and that has some kind of has some regulatory effects on our behavior as a society when we aspirationally cherish it. If that makes
sense, yeah,
like
absolutely.
And so. But it really does seem to me like this is an example of the worst kind of cynicism people have about the legal system, which is that it essentially is a system of subjugation by another name.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is truly what it is. It's interesting sort of thinking about this in the context of my brother, who I said lives down there. He also has spent time incarcerated and spent time locked up in Brunswick just by chance. But in between that time, he lived in Atlanta. He ended up moving back there for work. And everything that has happened to him that involves the criminal justice system could have gone a million different ways, right? Charges could have been dropped, could have been charged as a felony, could have been charged as a misdemeanor. And, you know, all of this is very interpretive. And in some ways, that is good when you think that you have someone with good judgment at the helm. You want the law to be slightly elastic to allow for the specificity of whatever situation you may be in. But in reality, when you don't have someone at the helm that you can trust or that is willing to take the steps to ensure that they're not compromised, or that isn't racist. I mean, I feel comfortable describing the DA as at least extremely racially discriminatory. You are in real trouble. People were saying to me the other day, this is a reason to get rid of prosecutorial discretion. Well, prosecutorial discretion is really good in a lot of cases, right? You have Larry Krasner, you have some of these incredible DAs across the country from Boston to Chicago to St. Louis to Orlando using their prosecutorial discretion in ways that are attempts to mitigate harm. But it can go either way. And really, it has come down in my head to, well, then what you really need is voter accountability. You really need to make sure that this is a transparent system, that people know who they're voting for and who they support.
I mean, part of the problem, right, is about the nature of the law and power relations and which is prior to which is to say, like, what we want is that, like, we want the law to restrain power and not for power to control the law. And so our hope is that the legal system acts as a kind of restraint from power and not simply the means by which power does its business. But in, like, a week where, like, Michael Flynn, the DOJ is going to drop charges against a guy who already pleaded guilty, who clearly did the thing that he would plead guilty to, which is that he lied to FBI investigators. And you end up in the same place as prosecutorial discretion, which is like every time it's someone in the Trump inner circle, like Donald Trump and all his cronies suddenly sound like they write for the appeal.
I know.
Like everyone gets like super woke on criminal justice. Like, so William Barr is like, well, you know, sometimes people plead guilty to things they didn't do. It's like, yeah, no shit, dude.
Check out
the criminal fucking justice system, homie.
Right.
Like how, like really that, right. Like Mike, like, thank you for giving us your like dollop of enlightenment vis-a-vis Michael Flynn.
Right.
And it's so maddening to watch these arguments get marshaled in these like Roger Stone, like Michael Flynn, like all the connected crooks and cronies of the president. We need to be like incredibly careful about due process and about prosecutorial misconduct and cops setting people up to lie. Like, oh yeah, holy shit, what do you think happens every day in America? But then out there in the real world, it's like they should all rot in hell.
Exactly. I mean, William Barr is just, to me, it's such a fascinating character, and that like he's really big on rule of law. I mean, this is a guy who wrote the case for mass incarceration. He wrote those words. He released that report, right? I mean, it is like he's just been on the wrong side of history on this repeatedly until it's his friends. And the
people he knows. Now he's like Mr. Like, oh, they were set up by the dirty cops.
Right. And, you know, I keep laughing about this woman in Dallas who, was arrested for opening her salon.
Yep.
As you know, because of the stay in place orders, and she was not supposed to have her salon open. She was arrested, sentenced to 7 days in jail. And you hear people say, her business shouldn't be illegal, or you can't send someone to prison for doing what they want to do to make a living. And it's like, that's the history of drug dealers. You guys have been sending people
the entire
to
trade,
prison.
Right?
Yeah.
This is my salon. It's called my corner which I give my haircuts. They're called weed.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, people don't want to think about, I mean, the past few weeks have actually made me both hopeful and sad. And one of the ways they made me sad is, I really would like to not think this is all racism. And in some ways, it's really hard to avoid that being the conclusion. Because
what do you mean by this? When you say this is all this, meaning?
I think a lot of criminal justice policy in the past and rhetoric in the past 20, 30 years, if you can find it in your heart to forgive Michael Flynn or to believe that he really didn't mean to do something wrong, that alone I can handle.
Yeah.
If you can't find that for all of these other people, that's a question of class and race, fundamentally.
Although there's also the other side of this, which is something that I always try to stress, and I wrote about a bit in A Colony and a Nation, is like, it's also the case that like the super punitive, vindictive system that we built based on racism and racial animus, it's not like it doesn't get white people. So it's like,
when
I don't know if it was that, I don't think it was that woman's business, but there was another business in Texas that opened in violation of the governor's orders. And they like came with like an MRAP, like a surplus, like armored personnel carrier. And like four dudes come out with like long guns and bulletproof vests. And there are all these conservatives rightly posting the link being like, this is nuts. It's like, yeah, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nuts. But that's the system we built.
Totally.
Like that happens all the time. Like you are right. This is nuts. We should not do that. But like, what do you think is going on? This is like a day in the life in America.
You know, Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, who wrote Golden Gulag and is kind of the thinkers I admire most, her and Miriam Kaba, talk a lot about this, right? Like, yes, this is a racially discriminatory system. People who are of color are paying a higher price than white people in the system. But it's not like white people aren't paying a price.
Right.
There are a lot of white people in prison. When we're talking mass incarceration, we are talking also a lot of white people. When we're talking about the harms of the system, it doesn't just fall on people of color. It falls disproportionately on people of color, but that's a different thing. I think it is really...
And you're seeing that with the virus too. And I think that like, I had, you know, it was funny. I had Ta-Nehisi on a few weeks ago, and like the setup for the piece was kind of about like these disproportionate effects, right? As the racial data becomes clearer, it becomes very clear that like African Americans have been disproportionately getting sick and dying from the disease. It's particularly, particularly acute in places like Detroit and Mississippi, et cetera. And Ta-Nehisi came on and was like, all that's true, but I don't want anyone to think it's not going to come for them.
Exactly.
Like, I don't want to like let people put this in some box in their head.
Right.
Of like those other people get sick because like that's not the way it's going to work.
Right. And you really see that. I mean, it's so interesting. People also talk about this in the opioid epidemic, right? Well, now that it's opioids, we're so good about it. We're so great. We believe in treatment. I mean, to some extent, it is true that the way we talk about drugs has evolved. The more that people who are, making the policy are affected by it. Or see people who look like them affected by it. But it's also not true that we're great on opioids, right?
We did a whole episode of this, but like it is true. Like the rhetoric has gotten better, but at the local level, if you go to like white parts of this country where they're having an epidemic, they're like, lock them up.
Lock them all the way up.
Throw away the key.
Like, and not only that, like, you know, if you're with your girlfriend and you both use drugs and she dies, like we're going to prosecute you for murder. Yeah. I mean, you see that all the time now. I mean, this is an interesting thing also with this kind of the way that we're handling the pandemic, where we are relying on criminalization to kind of keep people inside. Right. You hear these stories about people getting arrested for being at the playground or whatever. And on some level, it's like, okay, sucks for you that you finally understand what it's like for 2 seconds. But on the other hand, it's actually pretty terrifying.
No,
right?
I think it's a bad idea. I have to say, actually, it's interesting because we were talking to a good friend of ours who's in Argentina. I think actually it's weird. America's a very over-policed place, but I actually think we've been doing less of that on shelter in place than other places. Like in Argentina, she's like, cops write you a ticket. If they see you out, you get a ticket. People carry shopping bags as like weird cover, but then they ask you like, there's like a whole thing.
Oh, interesting.
Obviously in China, it was like, I mean, China's a crazy, surveillance state. But I actually, weirdly, I think in a comparative sense, we've actually been a little more like voluntary with the orders.
Mm-hmm.
Than some other places. And I'm really curious about, I'm actually going to talk to Michelle Alexander on the show tonight about that. I have the strong belief that we should not be using police and criminal law enforcement as a tool for enforcing a new social norm in the era of a pandemic, which we're trying to like basically build up as a collective enterprise between people and not as like an order of the state, you know?
I mean, I think fundamentally what we're seeing is that it backfires when you rely on criminal justice to kind of do what should be done sort of culturally
by
society. This is what happens. People start feeling like they are it's tyranny versus necessity. But it is also a reminder that if this system had legitimacy with people, if people felt like we had a criminal justice system that's main goal was safety and to keep people safe, they also might be more okay with, you know, being written a ticket or see that as sort of a social cost that they're willing to take. As it is, they're not. And I don't blame them. You
cannot divorce the two.
No, you really can't.
The law without legitimacy and consensus is basically tyranny. And that's the way that it's experienced by huge, huge amounts of people on a day-to-day basis.
And you can see how it just goes to an extreme. I mean, I get annoyed at people saying, the one that gets me is if I have to wear a face mask, that's unconstitutional, which is like, okay, but you have to wear pants. Like people like, you can't just walk around naked. So I don't understand why the face mask itself is the thing that like is the straw that breaks
the Constitution. Are pants in the Constitution? They are not.
Right. I'm sure that's going to come up at some point over the next
few funny thing is like, it's the same people who are like, I have a constitutional right not to wear a mask who are like going to be like rolling up on some citizen's arrest shit when they're like someone's blasting music too loud.
Exactly. Like, they're the same people. Exactly.
It's same.
You can imagine what the McMichaels were saying last week, right? Yeah, I mean, before what people who want actually to control their neighbors, don't want to be controlled. And this is all a tough balance, right? It's hard to figure out where the criminal justice system fits into the world we live in right now versus the one we want to live in.
That's a really, really, really well said, particularly at this moment. Everything seems like it's in flux. Joey Z. Duffy Rice is a journalist and a lawyer and president of The Appeal, which I really, really think you should check out if you haven't. It's a tremendous resource. She's also host of the Fantastic Justice in America podcast, which you should also check out. Josie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Once again, my great thanks to Josie Duffy Rice, and I meant what I said about The Appeal. It's really fantastic. Great resource for everything criminal justice related. We'd love to hear your feedback. Tweet us with the hashtag withpod. Email us at withpod@gmail.com. Don't put two at symbols in there. Why would you do that? That would not work. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team and Kate Shaw, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.